Welcome to another episode of Behind the Evidence AODH, a podcast supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. I'm one of our co-hosts, Mark LaRochelle, an addiction-focused primary care physician at Boston Medical Center.
And I'm Honora Englander, an addiction medicine physician and health services researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. On Behind the Evidence, we seek to engage with recent practice-relevant literature related to substance use. The podcast draws from articles reviewed in the AODH newsletter and aims to understand what's behind the evidence through conversations, including with authors.
Excellent. Well, let's jump into today's episode.
In today's episode, Honora and Mark interview two authors of articles reporting on wounds attributed to xylazine exposure among people who use drugs. The first conversation is with Dr. Ashish Thakrar of the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Then Honora and Mark spoke with Dr. Ragini Jawa of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. You can find links to the summaries of these articles in AOD Health in the show notes. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, everybody. It's our pleasure to be here today with Dr. Ashish Thakrar, who's going to be speaking about his paper, Wound Characteristics Among Patients Exposed to Xylazine. Dr. Thakrar, thank you for being with us today. Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me. I live in Philadelphia. I am a physician and researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Clinically, I see patients in the inpatient setting as an addiction consult physician, and then I also see patients in the outpatient setting, where I do primary care and integrated addiction treatment. And then my research focuses on improving, scaling addiction treatment for this era we're in of synthetic drugs like fentanyl and xylazine.
Great. Welcome, Ashish. It's nice to have you today. I was wondering if you could start by telling us what xylazine is.
Yeah, absolutely. So xylazine, as I'm sure many of our listeners have already heard of, it's an alpha-2 agonist. That means is that it inhibits the release of norepinephrine and dopamine in the central nervous system that leads to sedation, muscle relaxation, and bradycardia. It's not FDA approved for use in humans. So right now it's only used medically as a veterinary sedative. Typically that's for large animals for brief periods of procedural sedation, for example, horses or other large animals.
Great. And so I think our audience is also aware that xylazine is being reported as an adulterant in street drugs for several years now, in particular fentanyl. And I was wondering what we know about why it's being added and what people who use drugs experience with xylazine.
Yeah, I think it's always an important question, right? Why is it in the street supply? I think our best sense of this comes from some ethnography work that others have done in Philadelphia and other regions. And it seems like it's being added to, quote, give the dope legs. The high from fentanyl doesn't seem to last as long as the high from heroin or other short-acting opioids folks were using. And so the thought is that xylazine could potentiate some of that high, make it last a little bit longer, make the effects a little bit more potent. It's probably also worth mentioning that xylazine, at least for a while, was fairly cheap and easily available. So I think that probably plays a large role. I'd also just maybe direct listeners to some really incredible reporting in the New York Times about what was happening kind of at the level of cartels and where fentanyl is being synthesized and where some of the xylazine is being added. As actually fairly young, sometimes high school students or first year college students even adding some of these additives. So there's a sense in which we sometimes give assume there's a lot more thought and being put into why some of these compounds are added, but sometimes it's as simple as it seems like it worked in some other settings, and then if it's available and cheap, it sometimes spreads.
That's really interesting. So our focus today is on wounds, and xylazine is really seen as the putative agent of these wounds we're seeing. But can you tell us what led us to believe xylazine might be causing these wounds we're seeing, and any theories about the pathophysiology of how xylazine might be acting to cause these wounds?
Yeah, so xylazine first emerged as an adulterant in illicitly manufactured fentanyl in Puerto Rico. And some research from the 2010s in that area was the first to really report that patients found they had more skin lesions, skin ulcerations. There were some images from studies in that era. And then once xylazine rapidly started emerging in the drug supply in 2020 and later in Philadelphia, we just started seeing such an increase in this new type of wounds that we hadn't been seeing before. I think some of our listeners might be aware xylazine was around, but just in low levels. It would be uncommonly detected. And when it was detected, the thought that it was there in very low amounts in the drug supply before 2020. So it's not that it just wasn't there at all. It just was rarer and seems like it was in less amount. That really shifted in 2020 in Philadelphia, at least. We were lucky at the time to have really strong drug checking, where they actually had reports of the quantitative amount of different drugs and adulterants in our supply. And we saw a really steep increase starting in 2020 and certainly progressing through to 2023. And really coincident with that increase, we started seeing many, many more of these wounds. So I think for those of us practicing in Philadelphia, especially a lot of the folks doing street-based harm reduction work and wound care work, it just felt very obvious. But I think, you know, you're alluding, Mark, to a really important point, which is we don't quite know exactly why xylazine is causing these wounds or what role xylazine might be playing, if it's actually the single cause or just contributing to it.
It's great to hear kind of the context in Philadelphia. Tell us about what you were hoping to learn in this study and sort of what was your objective? How did you approach it?
The main goal we had was to try to describe a little more formally what do xylazine wounds look like. We were seeing them a lot. I think those of us working here had a sense of what these wounds looked like, but it wasn't formally described, we felt, in the literature. There were a few case reports, maybe case series, but none that kind of systematically said, what do xylazine wounds look like? And we thought that might be important because we were hearing there was a wider concern from folks in other regions saying, oh my gosh, are these wounds we're seeing xylazine wounds? We don't know if we have xylazine in the drug supply. We might not be testing for it in other geographic areas. So I think it can be important for that. Also, some of the more prominent examples in the literature felt atypical for us. I think, for example, there was a New England Journal of Medicine clinical image of a clavicular osteomyelitis complication of xylazine wounds, and we just weren't seeing very much clavicular injury. So we felt like, okay, you know, if there are these prominent examples that felt atypical and this concern that, you know, what is and isn't a xylazine wound in other areas, it was really worthwhile trying to be a little more systematic to try to capture and describe what do xylazine wounds look like.
Great. Ashish, can you tell us how you identified your sample and what you actually did to characterize these wounds in the population you looked at?
Yeah, sure. So we first wanted to identify patients who we knew had exposure to xylazine. We did that using a urine gas chromatography mass spectrometry test. It was developed by our University of Pennsylvania lab, tested in the urine, and it had been available in the electronic health record to be ordered for about 10 months when we collected data. This was fantastic because this mass spec test was really highly specific. Anyone who tested positive, we know, had xylazine exposure. We really didn't know its sensitivity, though. It was still a newer test. And given the high prevalence in the community of xylazine, we felt like the negative predictive value would be pretty low of the negative tests. So that's one of the main reasons we didn't take the approach of trying to compare xylazine positives to xylazine negatives, at least in this study. So we wanted to just focus on patients who we knew with confidence had exposure to xylazine. So we said, did they have this positive test from the urine? And then second, did they present for a wound-related issue? That was just so that we can narrow the sample somewhat and actually make it feasible to do detailed chart review. So that led us to our cohort of patients. Those ended up being 29 unique patients. And then we tried to characterize what the wounds look like. And we wanted to describe four main components: location, where were these wounds, how big were they, what did the wound beds look like, and then how long had the wounds been around, if that was listed in the chart based on patient report. And then when we started getting into these, the chart review, we realized a lot of patients had many wounds, not just one or two. Many had four, five, six. So we then had to further limit the sample, and we decided to focus on just three of the largest wounds, with the idea that those were probably the ones that had the most clinically significant impact for patients and for health systems.
Excellent. So can you tell us what you learned?
Absolutely. I'll first just describe a little bit of this sample so that folks can understand who it was that we ended up identifying. 29 patients. These were mostly young folks, two-thirds younger than 40, even mixed male and female, 75% white, and more than 50% reported either street homelessness or unstable housing. Of the group, 100% were using fentanyl. I would say about a half were using a lot, for lack of a better term, because in Philadelphia, that would be about more than a bundle a day, and about 80% were injecting. So these were folks with, I think we'd fair to say, is pretty severe opioid use disorder, fentanyl use, using a lot and very often injecting. And in that cohort, we had 59 wounds that we described. I think one of the key findings for us was that 90% of wounds were on the extremities, and most of these wounds were located on the extensor parts of the limbs. That would be the back of the arms or the front of the legs, for example, the shins. About 60% of the wounds had devitalized wound beds. So that's either the black necrotic eschar or slough, which is also a devitalized wound bed. Many of the wounds are large. At the same time, there was this group of smaller wounds. These were sometimes smaller blisters, sometimes multifocal blisters, sometimes in areas like the fingers. So it was a little bit heterogeneous. It wasn't just that one kind of large wound bed type that I think sometimes gets the most attention. And then the last key finding is that wounds that had been around longer were more commonly larger and more commonly had that devitalized tissue. So our interpretation of that was that it suggests thousand wounds might progress from ulcerations. They're sometimes isolated to becoming kind of multifocal ulcers with maybe mixed tissue wound beds. And then if untreated, they can progress to confluent areas with the devitalized tissue and larger wounds.
I'm interested in if any of these results surprised you. And I'll start by saying one thing that surprised me is that 87%, if I'm reading the data correctly, were reported at sites of injection drug use. And one of the things I had learned from trying to gather information of this is that it doesn't have to be at the site of injection. So that was maybe a little higher than I would have thought. So I don't know if you have any comments on that and if there's anything that was surprising to you.
Yeah, I think I'm really happy you brought up that point. And I think it's complicated. Some of what we found was consistent with that. 20% of people in the study didn't inject drugs at all, but still presented to a hospital for wound-related issues. It didn't make it into the paper, but I can just tell you that by and large, a lot of those wounds were smaller and they featured non-necrotic wound beds like ulcers. So I think that's consistent, right? Some of these wounds we're seeing do seem to show up for people who don't inject. And then for people who do inject, sometimes they show up in places where they're not sticking needles, like, you know, their finger knuckles. I think some of those smaller wound beds and some of those smaller wounds or those ulcerative kind of wound beds are sometimes showing up, even if you don't inject. But I think the larger necrotic wounds are the most prominent in kind of lay media also, those seem to really almost exclusively be in people who are injecting. And I think just from my clinical experience, the causal arrow sometimes goes both ways. Folks sometimes are not injecting into their shins. They develop some of these ulcers. And then once they become confluent, painful, heavily vascularized, they might start injecting into that. And then it can actually make the wounds even worse. So it's pretty complicated. I think it speaks to the need for prospective longitudinal research in this space. But yeah, it surprised us too. by finding. I think you asked what else surprised us. I think two other things. One was that only 9% of the wounds had exposed deep structures. In our experience in this era, I thought that number would be higher because some of these wounds are truly, they're rough. They're hard to see, and I think really disfiguring for patients. I don't know how much of that is our own clinical bias. You know, the most severe cases are the most memorable. But I think another possibility is that a lot of the images are captured when patients are first admitted, not after they've had the debridement that can sometimes show that underneath the eschar, there actually is, like, the first area of viable tissue is that exposed, what would be exposed tissue after debridement. So I think it could be a mix. And then the second surprise was that there were no amputations, skin flaps, or skin grafts performed. We had two thoughts as to why that might be the case. One was that at this time, a lot of surgeons in our system were declining to operate for patients with very heavy, very recent use, and they were requesting a period of abstinence before operating because of concern that ongoing use could compromise a skin graft or skin flap. And at the same time, I think there was practice. I think practice was moving away from amputations for very good reason. There were some experts in the harm reduction space in Philadelphia at Prevention Point, and also some of the wound care and burn surgeons from Temple, like Dr. Lisa Ray, who were really advocating to avoid amputation because some of these wounds, if seen in context aside from xylazine exposure, you might assume that they were could not heal. But we actually were starting to find that with consistent wound care and potentially stable housing, a lot more of them could heal than we would have thought. The practice was kind of shifting away from amputation locally as we did this work.
That's fascinating. One follow-up question that I have that surprised me when I read your paper was that over half, or I believe around half of people had a patient-directed discharge from the hospital. And I was curious just sort of what you make of that, either related to the population or their experience.
Yeah, I was going to touch on both of those. I think the first is the population. These are individuals with really severe addiction, I think, that we were seeing. And some, you know, they're presenting the hospital. These are often patients who were not able to be cared for in an outpatient setting or couldn't access outpatient care. So I think, you know, on one level, this is a reflection of some of the severity of the use disorder and heaviness of their fentanyl use. I think it's probably a larger part of this shows how our systems of care are really not serving them well. And I think that's where I would put the emphasis, which, you know, I could speak to that on a number of levels. I think one of the main challenges is treating withdrawal and pain in this population. And at this time, at University of Pennsylvania hospitals, there were either no addiction consult services or just one hospital had, I believe, had started one. So a lot of patients were being seen in hospitals without addiction experts available to offer, I think, some of that care for withdrawal and pain. And then I also think there was just a lot of uncertainty about how to actually manage these wounds. There still is, although I think we're getting better at it now. But there was a lot of kind of passing the buck where, you know, the primary team would maybe want to say, oh, let's start antibiotics and infectious disease. Well, it's actually not an infection appropriately. Contact the surgical colleagues. The surgical colleagues would say, well, we can't do anything until the patient's abstinent. There's no addiction consult service. It's just a bit of a merry-go-round for these patients. It can be really horrible to, you know, have someone who you're seeing in the outpatient setting trying to convince to get into the hospital. They finally do it, and then they're there, and then you feel, and they feel stuck. So I think that's a little bit of what it, I think, might have felt like at the time and some of the challenges of this interdisciplinary care that's needed in an area where there's not a lot of data to guide what we should be doing.
Thanks. You know, that leads to my next sort of more broad question, which is, what do you see as the major implications for this study? And I'll ask it in sort of two parts, which is, I think there are implications for regions in the U.S. where there's sort of a known xylazine, and then there are other regions where we're not really seeing xylazine at this point. And I think there's some potentially really important implications there as well.
Yeah, I would split it in that same way myself. And so I think in areas with heavy xylazine penetrance, I think it's so important to try to integrate wound care into other aspects of addiction care and primary care for these patients. And I think it's easy for me to say that. It can be a little hard to actually put that into practice. I think as internists, and all three of us are on this call, I think we actually have the training to, and we have colleagues who can teach us about how to do this work. And I knew very little about wound care before working with some of the wound care nurses, who are co-authors on this paper. And they taught me a lot, and there's a lot that we can do to integrate it. So I think being able to offer wound care at every touch point is really important. So I think that becomes a bigger challenge outside of like a primary care setting when we think about larger systems, because a lot of these patients end up being stuck where they might be willing and interested in going to an addiction treatment facility, but that addiction treatment facility doesn't feel like they can manage wounds. You have a skilled nursing facility that does manage wounds, but does not offer addiction treatment or has not figured out how to offer methadone or buprenorphine, or might just frankly reject patients with addiction because of stigma. So I think anything we can do to increase coordination between these different, often siloed parts of our healthcare system, from outpatient to inpatient to like residential drug treatment programs and skilled nursing facilities, I think it's really important. I also think really important to coordinate with our surgical, infectious disease, emergency med colleagues. I think all of these folks really do want to offer the best care they can for patients. And I think it's sometimes easy for those of us who are addiction specialists to say, oh, they're not offering the best care because it's stigma and it's all stigma. And I think sometimes it's stigma, but I actually think sometimes it's a matter of us understanding what the limitations are and what they can and can't do, and what the implications are of ongoing use. So I kind of initially thought, oh, patients aren't being offered some of these flaps and some of these surgeries and reconstructions because of that. But seeing the consequences of people who are still using after those procedures, it can be even worse for patients. So I think trying to meet not just patients, but fellow clinicians where they are in service of improving care for patients could be really important. And then I know it's a long answer to just the first part of, implications for heavy xylazine penetrance, but how about areas that don't have xylazine yet? I think being on the lookout for these types of wounds can be really important. I think a lot of people who use drugs, and especially who inject, can develop wounds that are not xylazine wounds. So every wound in someone using fentanyl is not necessarily a xylazine wound. I'm hoping that some of the pictures we provided, the heat map of where wounds are, can help people say, okay, do we think we're getting more xylazine in our area? Is it worth devoting resources to developing the clinical testing that we need? We do have xylazine test strips that are pretty widely available, so hopefully more folks can use those also in the meantime. Yeah, and I guess just the last thing I'll say for that those areas, it felt a bit like a tsunami when this happened. Like it just kind of all of a sudden ramped up, and then all of a sudden it felt like these wounds were everywhere amongst our patients who were using. So I would say if you're in an area without xylazine, I might not wait just for it to get really bad first. Trying to plan ahead can be really important.
Dr. Takrar, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that Mark and I have both learned so much from speaking with you and that our listeners will as well. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now excited to welcome Dr. Jawa from the University of Pittsburgh to join us and talk about her study that was published in Drug and Alcohol Dependence at the end of last year, Drug Use Practices and Wound Care Experiences in the Age of Xylazine Adulteration. Dr. Jawa, thanks so much for joining us. Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I am a clinician investigator at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Research in Healthcare. And clinically, I practice as an infectious disease and addiction medicine physician primarily taking care of people who use substances with infectious complications of their drug use. And I work at our local surgeon service program called Prevention Point Pittsburgh, providing low barrier wound care for folks in all stages of use.
Terrific. We're so glad to have you today. Maybe just to start, tell us about what motivated your study and what you were hoping to learn.
So I had the privilege of working with the Graykin Center for Addiction Training and Technical Assistance in early 2022. I think it was in the summer of 2022 with Stephen Murray, and we were tasked to educate folks across the country on xylazine-associated clinical harms. And it was really at a time when there wasn't much of data aside from case reports. And so we began this venture trying to understand how are people in the community impacted by the changing drug supply and what are the clinical harms that we need to teach providers about so that they can screen for the changing drug supply in their own geographic regions. And so in this data less area, we really learned from mutual aid from people from across the country. And many of the attendees of those trainings were people who were actively using substances or were people with lived experience or were folks from certain service programs. So the study was driven primarily out of the fact that we were taking the anecdotes that we were learning from folks in the community about the changing drug supply, and we wanted to get more rigorous data from people who are directly impacted, those who are accessing certain service programs, about like how xylazine and is impacting their bodies and their drug use habits and their healthcare utilization. So that's really what the inspiration of the study came from, is a need to get rigorous data in a time when we lacked it.
Excellent. So can you tell us more about what you hope to learn and how you went about learning it?
Sure. So really, it was quite organic. We came to be a team of folks with people with lived experience, clinicians were in the front lines, folks in the harm reduction community, to really try to outline what are the key questions that we as frontline providers have about how xylazine is impacting people who are using drugs. And we went to certain service programs really to ask what are people complaining about, to help guide what would eventually have become our measure. We decided to do a cross-sectional study based in Massachusetts, where xylazine was not fully ubiquitous in the fentanyl supply, but it was starting to have much more of a presence, to try to understand, you know, what were some of the experiences from people. And we ended up partnering with three certain service programs in distinct geographic locations in the state of Massachusetts to represent individuals who are using substances in both urban, suburban, and more or less rural SSPs, to knowing that drug use experiences and healthcare experiences can be really heterogeneous depending on where people are located. And so we partnered with these three SSPs with this idea of putting together a study. It was not funded by anyone. It was mostly using my seed funds and the donated time of people who are really worried about the communities to come together to put together this rapid study. And basically what we decided to do is we created a survey measuring a few things. One is, what are some of the drug use behaviors that people are engaging in who may have been exposed to xylazine? What were some of their wound care experiences and their healthcare experiences? But also some unpublished data that is going to be published soon. Really, how are their risk mitigation strategies changing with time, and are their routes of use changing? And so that is not published in this particular manuscript, but that should be forthcoming. And really trying to round out data For things that we were talking about in the field and were educating frontline providers about, basically using anecdotes and clinical experiences. And so it was a cross-sectional study done at three sites. And these three sites, again, were heterogeneous in urbanicity, and they were all well attended certain service programs. And we knew that they all had access to some sort of drug testing on site. So we had a relative understanding of there was about 30 to 50% prevalence of xylazine adulteration in the fentanyl supply, knowing that this is something that is of imminent importance to this particular community. And we ended up making the measure because no other measure like this existed together as folks with lived experience, clinicians, harm reduction teams. And we ended up translating it in Spanish as well, because each of the three certain service programs that we were targeting also had a fair number of individuals who were bilingual or were predominantly Spanish speaking. And so we wanted to make sure that we were not missing out the experiences of people who were potentially not going to be represented with just an English survey that we often see done in the field.
So a couple follow-ons, because I find the methods here fascinating. So the use of syringe service programs as a place to do research is really interesting. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you engage the staff and the clients there. You talked a little bit about their engagement already in designing the surveys and stuff, but what about also in execution and then interpreting and publishing and sharing the results?
Yeah, so this was a truly community engaged project, because it was we didn't apply for a grant, we didn't do anything. It was all, we need to do this, we'll find the money, let's just get it done. And so this was motivated by certain service program workers and leaders who were all sort of engaged in the conversation. And so we ended up meeting via Zoom calls to try to put together this rapid analysis and find funding and to operationalize it and get IRB approval and to get local Department of Health approvals to do the study. And we had boots on the ground students work with us through the School of Public Health, who I was mentoring, and I flew from Pittsburgh and did the study with them. And we had SSP staff helping with patient recruitment, and really they were the boots on the ground to educate people. They were already doing a lot of the wound care and the education about what the changing drug supply was already. And as part of our efforts through our Graykin trainings, we had developed some patient-facing pamphlets talking about the changing drug supply that we had disseminated across the state. And so we had already partnered with these agencies. And so they were instrumental in recruitment of participants, giving space on their sites to do the surveys, and then were instrumental in interpreting the data. And then writing the manuscripts. So this was a community partnered project from start to end. And even before this manuscript was published, we immediately were able to share some of the most salient findings with SSP staff members and community members. Through Massachusetts has a certain service program virtual meeting every couple of months. And so we spoke with them and gave the most salient findings. And so I think that that was really an important experience for me as a junior investigator to see a study from the beginning to the end, but also to see how things can rapidly change about how we might do risk mitigation counseling for people who use substances in these communities.
And I'll just point out, I was blown away. You can in drug and alcohol dependence, you can see certain time frames. But you recruited 171 people and got data in a course of 4 weeks, which is just amazing. You did that August of 2023. You submitted a manuscript by February of 2024, which was in press by August of 2024. And 1 year may seem slow, but that's incredibly fast. So that's kudos to you and your team.
Thanks,
That's
Mark.
fantastic.
Thank you. I think that for us, it wasn't fast enough. We would have loved to see this in press way sooner. But again, a peer review takes a long time. I think as clinical public health providers, we operationalize the findings immediately. And so it was helpful for us to be doing the trainings for the providers through the Greek and Training and Technical Assistance Program, where we were able to see, okay, this is what the risk mitigation strategies actually need to be. This is what the data actually showed us. This is how we're going to educate thousands of people across the country. And so, yeah, it was really nice and timely.
That's great. Let's dig into those findings. Tell us what did you learn and talk us through it.
Sure. So we were hoping to recruit about 50 participants from each site. We ended up overshooting that because participants at these syringe service programs were so interested in sharing about their experiences with the changing drug supply that we had to even turn people away. And we had superseded our recruitment goals. And so we had about 170 plus people participate, of which 87% of the sample had had some sort of a 100% had had some sort of a drug-associated wound in the past year, but about 87% had had a wound consistent with xylazine in the past 90 days. And we ended up having a 90-day duration, really, because people who use drugs, particularly those who inject drugs, have a myriad of different types of wounds and skin and soft tissue clinical conditions. The other thing that part of our measure that we didn't address previously was that we recognize that skin and soft tissue infections are really prevalent in this patient population, and there's a fair amount of overlap with wounds, drug-associated wounds. And so we were really intentional about creating a graphic of what xylazine wounds look like based off of our clinical experience in Pennsylvania, which has a higher prevalence of xylazine at the time of the study, in the unregulated fentanyl supply. And so we had come up with those images really through our own clinical practice and published those independently of the study. And they have now become something that it is used in other sort of public health ventures. So we use that image as a way that we could ask people to visually, tell us, did they have these wounds? Because most of the case reports that had been in PubMed at that time were of folks who had had really severe necrotic ulcerations, which is not necessarily the experience of most people who have had some sort of xylazine ulceration. Then what we also found was that people who were using xylazine, or excuse me, people who had xylazine versus non-xylazine associated wounds, they were more likely to inject subcutaneously or skin pop. And that is a phenomenon that we often see as a risk factor for skin and soft tissue infections, and is very, it's what our patients were telling us, that if I miss my vein, I will get a wound. And so it was nice to have some data to corroborate some of the anecdotes that we had been hearing clinically. We also, when asking about healthcare utilization, the thing that was most salient was that majority of the people who had experienced xylazine-associated wounds experienced significant healthcare stigma, and received inadequate withdrawal and pain management, in the hospital settings. And so, again, no surprise, this is something that we find even in people who have opiate use disorder or any other substance use disorder, aside from having an adulterant in the mix, that healthcare stigma is prevalent, and withdrawal management and pain management often fall by the wayside in terms of priorities for managing these patients. But clinically, that worried us a lot because, and it helped us really. We were glad that we recruited from syringe service programs, knowing that people probably are not going to go to hospitals and other acute care centers for these clinical entities because of these healthcare associated barriers. So it was good that we recruited from an SSP because we were getting people at the lowest barrier location that they were already getting care at. And then, yeah, so those were some of our most salient findings. Another one that was important and was We were recruiting from certain service programs, and I think the assumption is that people who come to certain service programs are not engaged in addiction treatment. And I would push back on that and say that more than 50% of the people that were in our sample were engaged in some MOUD, so whether it's buprenorphine, methadone, or whatnot. And so I think that, and they are still continuing to use. And for those of us who are clinicians, we see that often because in the age of the changing drug supply, the potency of the drugs that our patients are using far supersedes the medical agents that we have to help them with their appropriate addiction treatment management. And so oftentimes people need to use on top and will have to use these low barrier certain service programs. So yeah, these were some of our findings.
Thank you. One of the things I was really struck by in reading your paper is kind of these multiple phenomena where there's difficulty accessing healthcare because of stigma, inadequate pain and withdrawal management. Also, that people, I was struck by the fact that about a fifth of people were turned away from withdrawal management or other substance use treatment programs. And then on top of that, people are on some level engaged in medication for opioid use disorder, but perhaps the fact that people are using is not acknowledged in those settings or sort of fully addressed in those settings. So to me, that's really seems like a perfect storm for people self-managing wounds and not presenting to healthcare to address wounds. Can you talk a little bit about that cycle and how you saw that play out in your findings and in your experience?
Yeah, I think it's for people who are actively using substances with the changing drug supply and the new clinical harms, specifically wounds that they're facing, this is not something that they wanted. And it exacerbates already terrible barriers to care that they have to face, and the fragmented care venues that they have access to. And we had heard anecdotes from folks in the field that people were not getting placements and detoxes because they were being refused because they had a wound and the detox didn't have access to wound care services. And so you could imagine if somebody's trying to get help for their addiction and their use, if their only option is going to a detox and they have a concurrent wound, they literally have no place to go. And it just gets back into the cycle of just ignoring the terrible consequences that people who use drugs have, and especially if they're not captured in ICD-10 codes or in hospital typical places where we would do data collection, right? If we don't see them in the hospital, we're not doing studies in the hospital. We think that, they're being taken care of somewhere else, and that's not necessarily the case, which is why it's really important to sort of go where they are. Time and time again, in some of the qualitative data that we collected, and again, our study was not intended to be qualitative at all, but the people had so much to say about their healthcare experiences that we felt it was necessary for us to bring that in some of the results. But people kept saying, I tried to get help. I try to go get wound care, and either I go to the hospital and they're not giving me withdrawal management, or they think my pain is not real, or I have no place to go. And so it was really telling for us, this particular study, because it then led to now multiple studies that we're doing to try to really reshape the healthcare experience for people with xylazine exposure so that we can be more responsive to the changing drug supply.
I'm wondering if you could summarize some key points and takeaways for folks.
Sure. One thing we didn't talk about was wound self-care, which Honora, you alluded to, was something that was really common for people with xylazine-associated wounds. People were having to dress their own wounds, diagnose themselves, find resources for themselves. And wound self-care, similar to skin and soft tissue self-care, is very much the norm for this patient population. And I think that the finding for us as clinicians and as researchers is to try to understand why that's happening. Is that because they're not interested in getting into health systems, that's not necessarily what we found, or is it that they actually feel more comfortable in low barrier settings, which is something that we had heard in this particular study, that sometimes the places that we have as traditional wound care programs are not necessarily built for patients who are using substances. They may not have the facilities to do withdrawal management and pain management. So that was an implication for our field, is as the drug supply changes, and as we're thinking about our health systems, how can we make them truly low barrier to support people who may choose to do wound self-management? And does that mean that we're just giving people wound care kits, or does that mean that we need to do more tailored education? And I think it's the latter. We need to do both. It's diagnosing people early for wounds, getting them the resources they need for wound care supplies, and then respecting their wishes if they choose to do their own wound care or not. The other point that I think is an implication for our field is that harm reduction practices become really critical when the drug supply is as tainted as it is. Safer drug use and abstinence is just, it's abstaining from drugs is just not the reality for many of these patients. And we have to talk to our patients about things that we often take for granted. How can we help them minimize reuse of equipment? How can we help people access veins if they are using intravenously to try to avoid skin popping? How can we diagnose these patients' wounds early to prevent sort of downstream worsening of their wound? And then I think the final thing is reshaping our health systems, especially in the hospital, to make sure that we don't ignore people who have pain and withdrawal. I think that for a long period of time, there has been this, we're not sure if people are having withdrawal symptoms with xylazine. We don't have the data to necessarily back it up because we don't have the COW scores to corroborate that. But I would argue our patients, if they have, even if they don't have physiologic symptoms, if they are complaining of withdrawal symptoms that we need, or if they're complaining about pain, I don't think that we have perfect measures to capture those, at least in clinical medicine to date, and really respecting their experiences and treating them symptomatically becomes key. And that was something that I took away, that this particular study, we need to emphasize that anticipatory pain management, withdrawal management will help keep people in the hospital so that they can actually have the chance of healing their wounds, and figuring out how we can create protocols to make that happen is really key. So we at UPMC had the privilege of creating a multidisciplinary work group as one of the sort of next steps of this particular study, where we championed bringing multiple disciplines together to try to streamline our clinical protocols for wound management and withdrawal management in the hospital, so that it could be streamlined across our health system. Because as we know, as the changing drug supply happens, people sort of do a whole bunch of whatever until we have best practice guidelines, but sometimes we don't have the tincture of time to wait for those best practice guidelines. So that will be in press shortly.
That's excellent. Is there anything you haven't mentioned or we haven't asked that you think would be important to share?
I think this particular study was really pivotal for me as an early stage investigator to demonstrate the wealth of experience and knowledge our community harm reduction organizations have. I think that we, as folks in academia who may have degrees after our names, even if we're partnered with these folks, sometimes can go with, that we know it all. We certainly do not. And I think that it was a humbling experience for me to have meaningful partnerships with certain service program teams and frontline harm reduction workers and even people in who are actively using and people in recovery. They are directly impacted by the changing drug supply, and in meaningful involvement of them should be not only a priority for all of us in addiction research, but it should be mandatory at this time. I think not including them would be unethical. And so that was a big teaching for me as somebody who's early in their stage. And I hope that we can continue to build on these partnerships for the future work we do together.
We, before talking to you, we had talked to Dr. Takrar, who described his study where they characterized what wounds of people who had been definitively exposed to xylazine looked like. And you're seeking out here as well to study people who've had wounds associated with xylazine. How did we come to understand that xylazine wounds were a thing? When, you know, this is still something relatively new in the drug supply?
Great question. And it's really by listening to our patients. I think that they're the ones that tell us when there's shifts in the drug supply that might change how their overdose symptoms may feel like, or, you know, if their intoxication symptoms may feel like. So similarly, the wounds, our patients were the ones who were telling us this is different. And that's who we need to listen to. It's our patients.
Terrific. Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your experiences and your study with our listeners. We're really grateful.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Behind the Evidence is hosted by Honora Englander and Mark LaRochelle. Production by Raquel Silveira. Editing by Casey Calver. Music and cover art by Mary Tomanovich. Miriam Kamarami is the Executive Director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center and Co-Editor-in-Chief of AOD Health, together with David Filene. Learn more about AOD Health and subscribe for free at www.aodhealth.org. Behind the Evidence is supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. It is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities.